So we are a festival of discovery. These are first-time filmmakers or debut filmmakers, not all of them. And what makes them too different is a lot of these filmmakers had stories that were rejected by the traditional film industry because they were too extreme. The topics were too extreme, or the filmmaking rationale of how they're going to make it was too extreme to fit in the industry mold. And so they've been rejected by the film industry, and most of these films have been financed off the backs of the filmmakers themselves, their families, their crowdfunding, and so on, which gives the films a certain vibrancy and passion. We got 8,000 submissions to the festival, showing roughly 200. And people always ask me what we look for in a film. Well, number one is story. There's many competent filmmakers who can make beautiful pictures with beautiful acting and editing, but there's no story. So we separate all the story ones into a pile, and then we have to go and see how we can fit this juggernaut of Rain Dance together, because how many films about plastic in the ocean can you have in one year? In fact, we do have one. The one we are screening is called The Plastic Ocean from America, which is a dynamic documentary which has just been picked up by Netflix in America.
The founder of the Raindance Film Festival, Elliot Grove. He'll tell me why audiences and filmmakers alike are becoming less likely to take risks. Today on The Cinema Show. Also ahead.
Dear President Muffley, I hope this finds you well. Indeed, I hope this finds you at all, given that your last known location was a bunker complex improvised from a mineshaft at an undisclosed location somewhere beneath the smouldering ruins of the United States.
Conspiracy theories, racist tirades, and lies, lies, lies. Politics just isn't what it used to be. Or is it? We'll write a letter to one of our favourite presidents, Dr. Strangelove's Merkin Muffley. Plus,
the film is not a traditionally narrative film in that it is more of the structure of poetry or of the mind than it is of sort of traditionally narrative cinema. I think that the character justified it. We at least sought out to make a film as psychologically and emotionally and aesthetically complex as the man himself.
On the anniversary of James Dean's death, we'll rewind exactly 65 years to when he was only just on the cusp of changing what it meant to be an actor. And 90s talk show queen Sally Jessy Raphael tells us about the last time she ever spoke to Audrey Hepburn. That's ahead on The Cinema Show right here on Monocle 24. Throughout the 1980s and 90s, anyone at home during the day with a habit of switching on the television from time to time would surely have known Sally Jessy Raphael. Alongside Oprah Winfrey and Phil Donahue, Sally shared the throne of daytime talk shows, giving her the chance to speak to some amazing people, including what turned out to be the last ever major interview with Audrey Hepburn. Hello and welcome to The Cinema Show, coming to you from Midori House here in London. I'm Ben Rylan. We'll talk to Sally about that encounter a little later. First, though, the Raindance Film Festival wraps up this Sunday here in London. Earlier this week, the founder of the festival, Elliot Grove, handed the filmmaker Ken Loach the festival's Auteur Award. I asked Elliot about how we define what makes an auteur and whether the increasingly crowded festival calendar is becoming perhaps a little too clogged.
It's really, really noisy out there, not just with film, but in your sector with magazines, for example. Monocle's a fantastic magazine, and anyone with any brains would be stupid not to get it, but they might pick up, I don't know, Harper's Bazaar or Vogue or God help them, Grazia magazine, and we're just bombarded with all this information. The trick to a festival, Raindance included, is to establish a unique voice, which we've been fortunate. I've got a fantastic team working with me, and we, by the way, we pay them in blood, sweat, and beers, by the way.
That sounds all right.
But they're passionate about what we do, and they're passionate about the types of films and the types of stories we have, and they're just dying for people to just take a chance on something. And if you ever come to Raindance, any screening, and buy a ticket and come out and say, that was really awful. Why did the festival screen that, just please let me or someone from the team know. We'll give you a full, no questions asked, on the spot, 100% refund.
So you've decided this year to hand down an auteur award to Ken Loach. Tell me a little bit about the background behind that decision. Why Ken Loach?
Well, Ken was one of the first industry people to actually come by years ago when I started Raindance and pat me on the back and say, keep going, keep going. He's a tremendously interesting man, just personally. I know him a bit. He's extremely generous. All those nice, fuzzy, warm things that we like all people to have, including yourself. But he has made some amazing movies, and he's also rebelled against the so-called system. He does get finance from the so-called film industry because he's Ken Loach now, but he's taken extreme chances with his movies and the topics that he's filmed, things like Sweet 16, which got the C word used as a 12 rated in Scotland rather than a 18. They wanted to ban the film because of all the C words in the film until he convinced them that people in Glasgow speak like that as noun, verb, and adjective. And some of his other films are just have pointed a finger in the most creative way to social injustices in the world that he knew that he could influence. He's also 80 years old this year, and I conned him into coming to receive this award on the grounds that we will all, united, sing him happy birthday.
Well, that convinced him. Wow.
Well, it's just too wacky. Yeah, you just couldn't say no to that.
So tell me about the Auteur Award then. Auteur is one of those words that seems to be thrown around maybe in some sectors a little bit too much. And sometimes I fear it is at risk of losing its relevance.
Yeah.
In this particular case, it would appear to be indeed quite relevant. Why does that word auteur apply to Ken Loach?
Well, he told me it doesn't apply to him because he's got a whole team. He's got Paul Laverty, he's got his producer and cinematography and so on, a whole team. But we think of the word of auteur specifically with Ken Loach because he's always the one that comes up with the idea and then he orchestrates all the team members to come together. Auteur can be a dirty word too because the director usually gets all the credit when the writer should get a lot of credit. Ken isn't like that. He recognizes the entire team.
Elliot Grove, the founder of the Raindance Film Festival, running here in London until this Sunday. Now, why can't we use nuclear weapons?
The surface of the Earth will be as dead as the moon.
Ah, come on, Mr. Sasky, ridiculous. Our studies show that even the worst fallout is down to a safe level after 2 weeks.
You've obviously never heard of cobalt thorium G.
Well, what about it?
Cobalt thorium G has a radioactive half-life of 93 years. If you take, say, 50 H-bombs in the 100 megaton range and jacket them with cobalt thorium G, when they are exploded, they will produce a doomsday shroud, a lethal cloud of radioactivity which will encircle the Earth for 93 years.
Oh, what a load of commie bull. I mean, after all.
Afraid I don't understand something, Alexei. Is the Premier threatening to explode this if our planes carry out their attack?
No, sir. It is not a thing a sane man would do. The doomsday machine is designed to trigger itself automatically.
But surely you can disarm it somehow?
No. It is designed to explode if any attempt is ever made to untrigger it.
Automatically.
It's a question you might imagine coming from the mouth of Lex Luthor or maybe Frank Underwood. Surely not a real president. Well, the nasty world of politics has certainly taken some fanciful twists of late. It's enough to make some of us turn to the world of fiction for a much-needed dose of reality. Here's Monocle's contributing editor Andrew Muller recording his thoughts in a letter to President Merkin Muffley from 1964's Dr. Strangelove.
Dear President Muffley, I hope this finds you well. Indeed, I hope this finds you at all, given that your last known location was a bunker complex improvised from a mineshaft at an undisclosed location somewhere beneath the smouldering ruins of the United States. In any other country, of course, you wouldn't have stood a chance with a name like that. Who would cast a vote for someone called Merkin Muffley? The answer is, of course, Americans, who, in non-cinematic jurisdictions in recent years alone, have returned to office the likes of Butch Otter, Zach Wamp, Young Boozer, and Dick Sweat. Perhaps, indeed, your prominence and theirs is some warped symptom of nominative determinism, that you are all, like Johnny Cash's boy named Sue, driven by desire to earn a good name to compensate for your bad one. No such luck in your case, of course. The only reason that history will not judge you harshly is that history pretty much ended on your watch. You might argue that this was more poor luck than poor management, that the presidency of the Cold War era was essentially an ultra-high-stakes game of pass the parcel, but tough. If you'd negotiated an agreeable détente with the Soviets, you'd have expected the credit, and so, having accomplished the opposite, you copped the blame. It is a common idle pastime to define presidents and politicians in terms of other presidents and politicians. Learned biographers of the director who put your administration's final hours on tape have sought to compare you to Dwight Eisenhower, or the Democrat nominee he twice bested, Adlai Stevenson. The reality is that you have little in common with either man beyond male pattern baldness. Eisenhower was not known for being either indecisive or for being overawed by belligerent military men, as you were. And while Stevenson may have been naive and too reasonable by half, he was no fool, and you were very definitely that. You tried, in fairness, even to the extent of attempting to help the Soviet Union forestall the nuclear attack launched upon it without your authorization by a cadre of mad American generals. But you failed. Failed to interdict accelerating insanity at the time, and clearly failed beforehand to institute coherent command and control protocols for the atomic arsenal at your command. It's not much consolation that, as we now know, you weren't the only US president to have been negligent on this front. Coded switches to prevent the freelance use of American nuclear weapons weren't fitted to American bombs and missiles until the 1970s. None of which, of course, protects you from the judgment of posterity. As the sign treasured by one of your real-world predecessors reminded, your desk is where the proverbial buck stops. Or at least it did before the building in which it sat, along with pretty much every other above-ground structure in your country, was obliterated as a consequence of your misjudgment. And your record is even more wretched when measured against most other silver screen occupants of the Oval Office. Their plotlines usually see them saving the planet from aliens or meteorites, or at least saving their country from assorted foreign marauders, rather than fumbling and bungling civilization into extinction. But in reminding us, like some inadvertent Canute, that our leaders are limited and fallible and as subject in their way to the caprices of uncontrollable forces as the rest of us, you have performed service of a kind, for which you are due thanks of sorts. Sincerely yours, Andrew Miller.
Thank you, Andrew. Still to come on The Cinema Show, we'll explore the life of James Dean 65 years ago, before his debut helped change the art of acting for the camera. And
you would think with high-powered women like that, I noticed you got top billing.
Oh, I'd been around a long time. I'm a very old broad.
That's Sally Jesse Raphael speaking to Jane Russell about her time working alongside Marilyn Monroe. We'll ask Sally about her interview with Audrey Hepburn 2 months before the screen icon passed away. Stay tuned.
Do you like good films? Well, you're in luck. The Cinema Show is presented in association with MUBI, the curated movie site of cult, classic and award-winning cinema. And we've got a special treat happening at the moment. Just for our loyal listeners, a whole month of movies for free. Head over to MUBI.com/monocle. That's MUBI/monocle. Because life is too short for bad films.
On next week's show, remember to wear a hat.
I think tomorrow is a Say Something Hat Day.
We're on location in Milan to visit the Borsalino Workshop, makers of famous headwear for many a discerning gentleman, including Indiana Jones.
Of course, it's Casablanca with Humphrey Bogart, especially the last scene of the movie, which is probably one of the most famous emotional goodbye scene that we can find in the whole cinema history.
And we'll take a front row seat at this year's London Film Festival. That's next week on The Cinema Show here on Monocle 24.
The Score, brought to you by The Cinema Show. Beetlejuice, Edward Scissorhands, Milk, Alice Through the Looking Glass. These are just a handful of films in a never-ending back catalogue of triumphant films that have been scored by Grammy Award winner Danny Elfman. A fantastically unique composer, Elfman soars when using a contemporary approach to traditional orchestration. His style is extremely adaptable, and genre very rarely draws boundaries around what Elfman is capable of. His soundtracks are beautiful, they are menacing, they are epic, and at times somewhat mischievous. Whether it be for an adaptation of a much-loved children's novel...
What do you call yourself?
Alice.
The Alice?
Or maybe even a much-loved adult novel.
Miss Calvin, are you all right? Christian Grey.
Elfman's prolific body of work has been the soundtrack for some of film and TV's most loved and notable figures, such as Your Friendly Neighbourhood Spider-Man, the masked billionaire hell-bent on bringing justice to Gotham's underworld, and of course, everyone's much-loved TV family, The Simpsons. Since his debut score in 1982, Danny Elfman has marched his way towards 75 award nominations. And with some exciting projects in the pipeline, it looks as though Elfman has no plan at stopping there. For Monocle, I'm Kieran Banerjee.
You're listening to The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. I'm Ben Rylan. It's been 61 years since James Dean crashed his Porsche 550 Spider at what's now known as James Dean Memorial Junction in California. Like Marilyn Monroe, Dean's fame is so ubiquitous, it seems to transcend any attempt at creating the definitive account of his short life. However, that didn't dissuade Matthew Mishery from giving it a shot. Though his film presents an imagined version of Dean before he became famous, shot in an artistic black-and-white fashion that suggests a strange sort of dream state. Joshua Tree, 1951, is screening on Mubi here in the United Kingdom from today. Let's hear from Matthew as he walks us through his non-biographical take on the myth of James Dean.
Say, you live around here?
A few blocks. By the pier.
Got anything to drink?
Do you like tequila?
Well, I guess fundamentally I wasn't interested in the biopic as a genre, and our film is not a biopic. It's a very narrow portrayal of a very narrow period in time, specifically this time period in 1951 before he's famous. And, you know, the film deals more with the creation and consequences of star making rather than the actual life of the star himself. And I suppose the idea of doing a traditional cradle to grave biopic, first of all, wasn't very interesting to me. I don't really like those kinds of films. And it had also sort of been done 10 years before. And so we tried to carve out a different approach and different time period in his life.
You know, a young man like me, they want something I have. If they want me, they're gonna have to pay.
I think we were interested in achieving a sort of a, you call it a dream state. You know, I would say that the film is not a traditionally narrative film and that its structure is more of the structure of poetry or of the mind than it is of sort of traditionally narrative cinema. And I think that the character justified it. We at least sought out to make a film as psychologically and emotionally and aesthetically complex as the man himself. That was our ambition, and I hope we at least somewhat succeeded in doing that. And, you know, we also wanted to address the idea of the star factory and to do it in a way that was dreamlike as opposed to gritty and realistic. That was never really the intent of this film, to convey any sort of cinematic realism. It was to explore both the process of star creation and also the possibilities of geography and place.
Speaking of racing, have you ever been in a drag race?
Are you kidding me?
I just thought I'd ask. No, gym races in the tradition, you might say. Real racing cars, real tracks. How fast will your car go?
Oh, an honest miles an hour. clocked. It'd run about 106, 7.
You've won a few races, haven't you?
Oh, one or two.
Where?
Well, I showed pretty good at Palm Springs. I ran a Bakersfield. Telling me the same
thing, morning, noon, and evening. I think the James Dean of our film is the James Dean of life, but also perhaps the James Dean of our own fantasies and creation. I mean, you know, James Dean lived only a very short time. He's been dead for very many years and really only made three films. Yet he lives on as a sort of an icon of not just of cinema, but of American culture. And how much of that is reality? How much of that is completely created in the minds of generations of cinema fans? That's certainly a question the film poses.
Matthew Mishery, the writer and director of Joshua Tree 1951, which is streaming on Mubi here in the United Kingdom from today. And finally today, let's switch our television dials back to, well, say, the early 90s.
We have all been glued to our television and radio watching the latest news from the Persian Gulf. There has also been news being made right here at home. All across the streets of America, from New York to Los Angeles, the voices of war protesters...
When Sally Jesse Raphael's TV talk show went off the air in 2002, the media marketplace was a very different one to when she premiered way back in 1983. Before that Jerry Springer brand of tabloid television took over the daytime airwaves, Sally's time slot occupied a near-extinct place on the schedule that allowed her to tackle an enormous variety of topics with some extraordinary guests. And, yes, with some rather unsavory attention grabbers thrown in there too. In late 1992, she sat down for a chat with Audrey Hepburn in what became the legendary star's final ever interview. Sally joins me now on the line from her home in New York. Sally, thanks so much for talking. Take us back to 1992. What was it like to be sitting opposite such an icon of the cinema?
It was on the television show, and it was 2 months before she died. I did speak at her funeral, by the way, or the funeral. She may have had two funerals. I spoke at the one that took place at St. Bartholomew in New York. She was my idol. She remained very right all through her life, meaning no sellout, working for the United Nations feverishly when she knew she was dying. An amazing, amazing person. And I think that was one of the high points of my career, and it was indeed a privilege to A, know her, and B, interview her, and C, be able to speak at her funeral.
Had you met her before you got the chance to interview her?
Yes, I had, because I spent a great deal of my life in Puerto Rico, so I'm considered somewhat Hispanic. We don't know in America what Hispanic means. So I had worked for the United Nations also in countries where they didn't have someone at that time who spoke Spanish. So yes, I had.
And what was she like to speak to in person? I think, I mean, we all have some sort of relationship with the image of Audrey Hepburn via her many classic movies. But what was she like to deal with on a face-to-face basis?
Well, face-to-face, she was physically all through to the very end. I have photographs of 2 months before she died. She was physically exquisite, a ballet dancer with wonderful wide features. Wide features always photograph better than narrow features. She had very much what Jackie Kennedy had. She talked in a very low, whispery voice, so that you had to lean in to her in order to get her. And there seemed to be a little humor behind everything she was saying, as if she was gently teasing you. She spoke like Jackie Kennedy, a high voice, a light whisper, and not terribly tall, but very, very thin and lithe. She was always the epitome of the word lithe.
Sally, always a pleasure to talk to you. And that's it for today's show. Next week, do remember to pop on a hat. We're off to the Borsellino Hat Factory in Milan, makers of famous headwear for, among others, Indiana Jones.
I've learned to do a lot of things, very physical things, and keep my hat on. And it's not by stapling it, really, but it's a lot of work sometimes to keep the hat on.
Today's show was edited by Kieran Matthew Banerjee and researched by Yolene Goffin. Listen again and find out more over at our website, monocle.com, and remember to subscribe to the podcast wherever you get your audio. The Cinema Show returns next week. I'm Ben Ryland. Thanks for listening.